Sword raised, Astarin was standing between her and Iskra, on the ground, face bloodied and swollen, her own second sword out and poised to meet Astarin's.
"He is fine,"
Sorrel said, squeezing her tighter.
"Abraxos is fine, Manon. Look at him. Look at him and see that he's fine."
Breathing through her mouth, thanks to her blood-clogged nose, Manon obeyed and found him crouching, eyes wide and on her. His wound had already clotted. Iskra hadn't moved an inch from where Manon had thrown her onto the floor. But Astarin and the other second were growling, ready to launch into another fight that might very well rip this mountain apart. Enough. Manon shook off Sorrel's firm grip. Everyone went dead silent as Manon wiped her bloody nose and mouth on the back of her wrist. Iskra snarled at her from the floor, blood from her broken nose leaking onto her cut lip.
"You touch him again," Manon said, "and I'll drink the marrow from your bones."
The Yellowlegs' heir got a second beating that night from her mother in the mess hall, plus 2 lashes of the whip for the blows she'd given Abraxos. She'd offered them to Manon, but Manon refused under the guise of indifference. Her arm was actually too stiff and aching to use the whip with any efficiency. Manon had just entered Abraxos's cage the next day, Astarin on her heels, when the blue-blood heir appeared at the stairway entrance, her red-haired second close behind. Manon, her face still swollen and eye beautifully black, gave the witch a tight nod. There were other pens down here, though she rarely ran into anyone else, especially not the 2 heirs. But Petra paused at the bars, and it was then that Manon noticed the goat's leg in her second's arms.
"I heard the fight was something to behold," Petra said,
keeping a respectful distance from Manon and the open door to the pen. Petra smiled faintly.
"Iskra looks worse."
Manon flicked her brows up, though the motion made her face throb. Petra held out a hand to her second, and the witch passed her the leg of meat.
"I also heard that your 13 and your mounts only eat the meat they catch. My Keely caught this on our morning flight. She wanted to share with Abraxos."
"I don't accept meat from rival clans."
"Are we rivals?" Petra asked. "I thought the King of Otterlin had convinced us to fly under one banner again."
Manon took a long breath.
"What do you want? I have training in 10 minutes.
Petra's second bristled, but the heir smiled.
"I told you. My Keely wanted to give this to him."
"Oh, she told you,"
Manon sneered. Petra cocked her head.
"Doesn't your wyvern talk to you?"
Abraxos was watching with as much awareness as the other witches.
"They don't talk."
Petra shrugged, tapping a hand casually over her heart.
"Don't they?"
She left the goat leg before walking off into the raucous gloom of the pens. Manon threw the meat away. Chapter 39. "Tell me about how you learned to tattoo."
"No."
Hunched over the wooden table in Rowan's room a night after their encounter with the creature in the lake, Selena looked up from where she held the bone-handled needle over his wrist.
"If you don't answer my questions, I might very well make a mistake, and..."
She lowered the tattooing needle to his tan, muscled arm for emphasis. Rowan, to her surprise, let out a huff that might have been a laugh. She figured it was a good sign that he'd asked her to help shade in the parts of his arm he couldn't reach himself.
The tattoo around his wrist needed to be re-inked now that the wounds from her burning him had faded.
Did you learn from someone? Master and apprentice and all that?
He gave her a rather incredulous look.
Yes, master and apprentice and all that. In the war camps, we had a commander who used to tattoo the number of enemies he'd killed on his flesh. Sometimes he'd write the whole story of a battle. All the young soldiers were enamored of it, and I convinced him to teach me.
With that legendary charm of yours, I suppose.
That earned her a half smile, at least.
Just fill in the spots where I...
A hiss as she took the needle and little mallet and made another dark, bloody mark in him.
Good. That's the right depth.
With his immortal, fast-healing body, Rowan's ink was mixed with salt and powdered iron to keep the magic in his blood from wiping away any trace of the tattoo. She'd awoken that morning feeling clear. The grief and pain were still there, writhing inside her. But for the first time in a long while, she felt as though she could see. As though she could breathe. Focusing on keeping her hand steady, she made another little mark, then another.
Tell me about your family.
Tell me about yours, and I'll tell you about mine,
he said through gritted teeth as she kept going. He'd instructed her thoroughly before he had let her take the needles to his skin.
Fine. Are your parents alive?
A stupid, dangerous question to ask, given what had happened with his mate. But there was no grief in his face as he shook his head.
My parents were very old when they conceived me.
Not old in the human sense, she knew.
I was their only child in the millennia they'd been mated. They faded into the afterworld before I reached my second decade.
Before she could think more on that interesting, different way of describing death, Rowan said,
"You had no siblings."
She focused on her work as she let out the thinnest tendril of memory. My mother, thanks to her Fey heritage, had a difficult time with the pregnancy. She stopped breathing during labor. They said it was my father's will that kept her tethered to this world. I don't know if she even could have conceived again after that. So, no siblings. But,
gods, she should shut her mouth.
But I had a cousin. He was 5 years older than me, and we fought and loved each other like siblings.
Adian.
She hadn't spoken that name aloud in 10 years, but she'd heard it and seen it in papers. She had to set down the needle and mallet and flex her fingers.
I don't know what happened, but they started saying his name as a skilled general in the king's army.
She had failed Adian so unforgivably that she couldn't bring herself to blame or detest him for what he'd become. She'd avoided learning any details about what exactly he'd done in the North all these years. Adian had been fiercely, wildly loyal to Terrasen as a child. She didn't want to know what he'd been forced to do, what had happened to him to change that. It was by luck or fate or something else entirely that he had never been in the castle when she was there. Because not only would he have recognized her, but if he knew what she had done with her life, his hatred would make Rowan's look pleasant, probably. Rowan's features were set in a mask of contemplation, as she said.
I think facing my cousin after everything would be the worst of it.
Worse than facing the king.
There was nothing she could say or do to atone for what she'd become while their kingdom fell into ruin, and their people were slaughtered or enslaved.
Keep working,
Rowan said, jerking his chin at the tools sitting in her lap. She obeyed, and he hissed again at the first prick.
Do you think,
he said after a moment,
your cousin would kill you or help you? An army like his could change the tide of any war.
A chill went down her spine at that word. War. I don't know what he would think of me, or where his loyalties lie. And I'd rather not know. Ever. Though their eyes were identical, their bloodlines were distant enough that she'd heard servants and courtiers alike pondering the usefulness of a Galathinius-Ash River union someday. The idea was as laughable now as it had been 10 years ago. "Do you have cousins?" she asked. "Too many." Mora's line was always the most widespread, and my meddlesome, gossiping cousins make my visits to Doranel irksome. She smiled a little at the thought. "You'd probably get along with my cousins," he said, "especially with the snooping." She paused her inking and squeezed his hand hard enough to hurt anyone but an immortal. "You're one to talk, Prince. I've never been asked so many questions in my life." Not quite true, but not quite an exaggeration either. No one had ever asked her these questions, and she'd never told anyone the answers. He bared his teeth, though she knew he didn't mean it, and glanced meaningfully at his wrist. "Hurry up, Princess. I want to go to bed at some point before dawn." She used her free hand to make a particularly vulgar gesture, and he caught it with his own, teeth still out. "That is not very queenly."
"Then it's good I'm not a queen, isn't it?"
But he wouldn't let go of her hand. "You have sworn to free your friend's kingdom and save the world, but will not even consider your own lands. What scares you about seizing your birthright? The king? Facing what remains of your court?" He kept his face so close to hers that she could see the flecks of brown in his green eyes. "Give me one good reason why you won't take back your throne. One good reason, and I'll keep my mouth shut about it." She weighed the earnestness in his gaze, his breathing, and then said, "Because if I free Eowe and destroy the king as Selena, I can go anywhere after that. The crown, my crown, is just another set of shackles." It was selfish and horrible, but it was true. Nehemia, long ago, had once said as much. It was her most ardent and selfish wish to be ordinary, without the weight of her crown. Had her friend known how deeply those words had echoed in her? She waited for the scolding, saw it simmering in Rowan's eyes, but then he quietly said,
"What do you mean, another set of shackles?"
He loosened his grip to reveal the two thin bands of scars that wrapped around her wrist. His mouth tightened, and she yanked her wrist back hard enough that he let go. "Nothing," she said. "Arobin, my master, liked to use them for training every now and then." Arobin had chained her to make her learn how to get free, but the shackles at Endovir had been crafted with people like her in mind. It wasn't until Kaol had removed them that she'd gotten out. She didn't want Rowan knowing that. Any of it. Anger and hatred she could handle. But pity. And she couldn't talk about Kaol. Couldn't explain just how much he had rebuilt and then shattered her heart. Not without explaining Endovir. Not without explaining how one day, she didn't know how distant, she was going back to Endovir and freeing them all. Each and every slave, even if she had to unshackle them all herself. Selena went back to her work, and Rowan's face remained tight, as if he could smell her half-truth.
"Why did you stay with Arobin?"
"I knew I wanted two things. First, to disappear from the world and from my enemies, but..." It was hard to look him in the eye. "I wanted to hide from myself, mostly. I convinced myself I should disappear, because the second thing I wanted, even then, was to be able to someday hurt people the way I had been hurt. And it turned out that I was very, very good at it. If he had tossed me away, I would either have died or wound up with the rebels. If I had grown up with them, I probably would have been found by the king and slaughtered. Or I would have grown up so hateful that I would have been killing Otterlanian soldiers from a young age. His brows rose, and she clicked her tongue. You thought I was just going to spread my whole history at your feet the moment I met you? I'm sure you have even more stories than I do, so stop looking so surprised. Maybe we should just go back to beating each other into a pulp. His eyes gleamed with near-predatory intent.
Oh, not a chance, princess. You can tell me what you want when you want, but there's no going back now.
She lifted her tools again. I'm sure your other friends just adore having you around. A feral smile, and he grabbed her by the chin, not hard enough to hurt, but to get her to look at him.
First thing, he breathed, we're not friends. I'm still training you, and that means you're still under my command.
The flicker of hurt must have shown, because he leaned closer, his grip tightening on her jaw.
Second, whatever we are, whatever this is, I'm still figuring it out, too. So if I'm going to give you the space you deserve to sort yourself out, then you can damn well give it to me.
She studied him for a moment, their breath mingling. Deal, she said. Chapter 40.
Tell me your greatest wish.
Dorian murmured into Sorsha's hair as he entwined their fingers, marveling at the smoothness of her tan skin against the calluses of his. Such pretty hands, like mourning doves. She smiled onto his chest.
I don't have a greatest wish.
Liar. He kissed her hair. You're the world's worst liar.
She turned toward the window of his bedroom, the morning light making her dark hair glow. It had been 2 weeks since that night she'd kissed him. 2 weeks since she'd started creeping up here after the castle had gone to sleep. They'd been sharing a bed, though not in the manner he still yearned to, and he detested the sneaking and the hiding. But she'd lose her position if they were found out. With him being who he was, he could bring down a world of trouble on her just for being associated with him. His mother alone could find ways to get her shipped off somewhere.
Tell me,
he said again, bending to snatch a kiss.
Tell me and I'll make it happen.
He'd always been generous with his lovers. Usually he gave them gifts to keep them from complaining when he lost interest. But this time he genuinely wanted to give her things. He had tried giving her jewelry and clothes, and she had refused it all. So he'd taken to giving her hard-to-come-by herbs and books and special tools for her workroom. She'd tried to refuse those, but he'd worn her down quickly, mostly by kissing away her protests.
And if I asked for the moon on a string?
Then I would start praying to Diana.
She smiled, but Dorian's own grin faded. Diana, Lady of the Hunt. He usually tried not to think about Selena, Aelin, whoever she was. Tried not to think about Kaol and his lying, or Adian and his treason. He wanted nothing to do with them, not now that Sorsha was with him. He'd been a fool once, swearing he would tear the world apart for Selena. A boy in love with a wildfire, or believing he was in love with one.
Dorian?
Sorsha pulled back to study his face. She looked at him the way he'd once caught Selena looking at Kaol. He kissed her again, soft and lingering, and her body melted into his. He savored the silkiness of her skin as he ran a hand down her arm. She yanked back.
I have to go. I'm late.
He groaned. It was indeed almost breakfast, and she would be noticed if she didn't leave. She shimmied out of his embrace and into her dress, and he helped tie the stays in the back. Always hiding. Was that to be his life? Not just the women he loved, but his magic, his true thoughts. Sorsha kissed him and was at the door, a hand on the knob.
My greatest wish, she said with a little smile, is for a morning when I don't have to run out the door at first light.
Before he could say anything, she was gone. But he didn't know what he could say or do to make it happen, because Sorsha had her obligations, and he had his. If he left to be with her, if he turned on his father, or if his magic was discovered, then his brother would become heir, and the thought of Holland as king one day, what he would do to their world, especially with their father's power. No, Dorian could not have the luxury of choosing, because there was no option. He was bound to his crown, and would be until the day he died. There was a knock on his door, and Dorian smiled, wondering if Sorsha had come back. The grin vanished as the door opened.
We need to talk, Kaol said from the threshold.
Dorian hadn't seen him in weeks, and yet his friend looked older, exhausted. Not going to bother with flattery, Dorian said, plopping onto the couch.
You would see through it anyway.
Kaol shut the door behind him and leaned against it. Humor me.
I am sorry, Dorian,
Kaol said softly.
More than you know.
Sorry because lying cost you me and her? Would you be sorry if you hadn't been caught? Kaol's jaw tightened. And perhaps Dorian was being unfair, but he didn't care.
I am sorry for all of it, Kaol said. But I've been working to fix it.
And what about Selena? Is working with Adian actually to help me, or her?
Both of you.
Do you still love her? He didn't know why he cared, why it was important. Kaol closed his eyes for a moment.
A part of me will always love her, but I had to get her out of this castle, because it was too dangerous, and she was what she was becoming.
She was not becoming anything different from what she always was and always had the capacity to be.
You just finally saw everything. And once you saw that other part of her,
Dorian said quietly. It had taken him until now, until Sorsha, to understand what that meant.
You cannot pick and choose what parts of her to love.
He pitied Kaol, he realized. His heart hurt for his friend, for all that Kaol had surely been realizing these past few months.
Just as you cannot pick which parts of me you accept. I don't.
You do.
But what's done is done, Kaol. And there is no going back, no matter how hard you try to change things. Like it or not, you played a role in getting us all to this point, too. You set her down that path, to revealing who and what she is, to whatever she decides to do now. You think I wanted any of this to happen?
Kaol splayed his arms.
If I could, I would put it all back to the way it was. If I could, she wouldn't be queen, and you wouldn't have magic.
Of course.
Of course you still see the magic as a problem. And of course you wish she wasn't who she is. Because you're not really scared of those things, are you? No. It's what they represent. The change. But let me tell you.
Dorian breathed, his magic flickering and then subsiding in a flash of pain.
Things have already changed. And changed because of you. I have magic. There is no undoing that. No getting rid of it. And as for Selena...
He clamped down on the power that surged as he imagined. For the first time, he realized what it was to be her.
As for Selena,
he said again,
you do not have the right to wish she were not what she is. The only thing you have a right to do is decide whether you are her enemy or her friend.
He did not know all of her story, did not know what had been truth and what had been lies, or what it had been like in Endovir to slave beside her countrymen, or to bow to the man who had murdered her family. But he had seen her, seen glimpses of the person beneath, regardless of name or title. And he knew deep down that she had not blinked at his magic, but rather understood that burden and that fear. She had not walked away or wished him to be anything but what he was. I'll come back for you. So he stared down his friend, even though he knew Kaol was hurting and adrift, and said,
I've already made my decision about her. And when the time comes, regardless of whether you are here or in Anio, I hope your choice is the same as mine.
Adian hated to admit it, but the captain's self-control was impressive as they waited in the hidden apartment for Murtaugh to arrive. Wren, who couldn't keep his ass planted in a chair for more than a moment even with his still healing wounds, paced around the great room. But Kaol sat beside the fire, saying little but always watching, always listening. Tonight the captain seemed different. Warier, but tighter, thanks to all those meetings where he'd carefully watched the captain's movements, every breath and blink. Adian instantly noted the difference. Had there been some news? Some development? Murtaugh was to return tonight, after a few weeks near Skull's Bay. He had refused Wren's offer to go with him and told his grandson to rest, which, though Wren tried to hide it, left the young lord anxious, ungrounded, and aggressive. Adian was honestly surprised the apartment hadn't been torn to shreds. In his war camp, Adian might have taken Wren into the sparring ring and let him fight it out, or sent him on some mission of his own, or at least made him chop wood for hours.
So we're just going to wait all night?
Wren said at last, pausing before the dining table and looking at them both. The captain yielded nothing more than a vague nod, but Adian crossed his arms and gave him a lazy grin.
You have something better to do, Wren? Are we interfering with a visit to one of your opium dens? A low blow,
but nothing that the captain hadn't already guessed about Wren. And if Wren showed any indication of that sort of habit, Adian wouldn't let him within 100 miles of Aelin. Wren shook his head and said,
We're always waiting these days. Waiting for Aelin to send some sign, waiting for nothing. I bet my grandfather will have nothing, too. I'm surprised we're not all dead by now, that those men didn't track me down.
He stared into the fire, the light making his scar look even deeper.
I have someone who...
Wren trailed off, glancing at Kaol.
They could find out more about the king. I don't trust your sources one bit, especially not after those men found you,
Kaol said. It had been one of Wren's informants, caught and tortured, who had given his location away. And even though the information had been yielded under duress, it still didn't sit well with Adian. He said as much, and Wren tensed, opening his mouth to snap something undoubtedly stupid and brash. but a three-note whistle interrupted. The captain whistled back, and Ren was at the door, opening it to find his grandfather there. Even with his back to them, Adian could see the relief flooding Ren's body as they clasped forearms, weeks of waiting without word finally over. Murtaugh wasn't young by any means, and as he threw back his hood, his face was pale and grim.
"There's brandy on the buffet table,"
Kaol said, and Adian, yet again, had to admire the captain's keen eyes, even if he would never tell him. The old man nodded his thanks and didn't bother to remove his cloak as he knocked back a glass of it.
"Grandfather?"
Ren lingered by the door. Murtaugh turned to Adian.
"Answer me truthfully, boy. Do you know who General Narok is?"
Adian rose to his feet in a smooth movement. Ren took a few steps toward them, but Murtaugh held his ground as Adian stalked to the buffet table and slowly, with deliberate care, poured himself a glass of brandy.
"Call me boy again,"
Adian said with lethal calm, holding the old man's stare.
"And you'll find yourself back squatting in shanties and sewers."
The old man threw up his hands.
"When you're my age, Adian..."
"Don't waste your breath," Adian said, returning to his chair.
"Narok's been in the south. Last I heard, he was bringing the Armada to the Dead Islands.
Pirate territory.
But that was months ago. We're kept on a need-to-know basis. I learned about the Dead Islands because some of the Pirate Lord's ships sailed north looking for trouble, and they informed us that they'd come to avoid Narok's fleet."
The pirates had scattered, actually. The Pirate Lord Rolf had taken half of them south. Some had gone east, and some had made the fatal mistake of sailing to Terrasen's north coast. Murtaugh sagged against the buffet table.
"Captain?"
"I'm afraid I know even less than Adian,"
Kaol said. Murtaugh rubbed his eyes, and Ren pulled out a chair at the table for his grandfather. The old man slid into it with a small groan. It was a miracle the bag of bones was still breathing. Adian shoved down a flicker of regret. He'd been raised better than that. He knew better than to act like an arrogant, hot-headed prick. Ro would have been ashamed of him for speaking to an elder in that manner. But Ro was dead. All the warriors he'd loved and worshipped were 10 years dead, and the world was worse for it. Adian was worse for it. Murtaugh sighed.
"I fled here as quickly as I could. I have not rested for more than a few hours this past week. Narok's fleet is gone. Captain Rolf is again Pirate Lord of Skull's Bay, though not more than that. His men do not venture into the eastern Dead Islands."
Despite the hint of shame, Adian ground his teeth when Murtaugh didn't immediately get to the point.
"Why?"
he demanded. The lines of Murtaugh's face deepened in the light of the fire.
"Because the men who go into the eastern islands do not come back. And on windy nights, even Rolf swears he can hear roaring. Roaring from the islands. Human, but not quite. The crew that hid in the islands during Narok's occupation claim it's quieted down, as if he took the source of the sound with him. And Rolf..."
Murtaugh rubbed the bridge of his nose.
"He told me that on the night they sailed back into the islands, they saw something standing on an outcropping of rocks, just on the border of the eastern islands. Looked like a pale man, but not. Rolf might be in love with himself, but he's not a liar. He said whatever, whoever it was, felt wrong. Like there was a hole of silence around it, at odds with the roaring they usually hear. And that it just watched them sail past,
The next day, when they returned to the same spot, it was gone.
There have always been legends of strange creatures in the seas, the captain said.
Rolf and his men swore that this was nothing from legend. It was made, they said.
How did they know?
Adian asked, eyeing the captain, whose face was still bone white.
It bore a black collar, like a pet. It took a step toward them, as if to go into the sea and hunt them down. But it was yanked back by some invisible hand, some hidden leash.
Wren raised his scarred brow.
The pirate lord thinks there are monsters in the Dead Islands? He thinks, and I also believe, that they were being made there. And Narok took some of them with him.
It was Kaol who asked,
Where did Narok go?
To Wendlin,
Murtagh said.
Adian's heart, damn him, stopped.
Narok took the fleet to Wendlin to launch a surprise attack.
That's impossible,
the captain said, shooting to his feet.
Why? Why now?
Because someone,
the old man said, sharper than Adian had ever heard him, convinced the king to send his champion there to kill the royal family.
What better time to try out these alleged monsters than when the country is in chaos?
Kaol gripped the back of a chair.
She's not actually going to kill them. She would never. It was all a ruse,
he said. Adian supposed that was all he would tell the Alsbrook men, and all they really needed to know right now. He ignored the wary glance Wren tossed him, no doubt to see how he would react to news of his Ash River kin having targets on their backs. But they'd been dead to him for 10 years already, from the moment they refused to send aid to Terrasen. Gods help them if he ever set foot in their kingdom. He wondered what Aelin thought of them, if she thought Wendlin might be convinced of an alliance now, especially with Otterlin launching a larger-scale assault on their borders. Perhaps she would be content to let them all burn, as the people of Terrasen had burned. He wouldn't mind either way.
It doesn't matter if they are assassinated or not, Murtagh said. When these things arrive, I think the world will soon learn what our queen is up against.
Can we send a warning? Wren demanded. Can Rolf get word to Wendlin?
Rolf will not get involved. I offered him promises of gold, of land when our queen returns. Nothing can sway him. He has his territory back, and he will not risk his men again.
Then there has to be some blockade runner, some message we can smuggle,
Wren went on. Adian debated informing Wren that Wendlin hadn't bothered to help Terrasen, but decided he didn't particularly feel like getting into an ethical debate.
I have sent a few that way, Murtagh said, but I do not have much faith in them, and by the time they arrive, it may be too late.
So what do we do?
Wren pushed. Murtagh sipped his brandy.
We keep looking for ways to help here, because I do not believe for one moment that His Majesty's newest surprises were located only in the Dead Islands.
That was an interesting point. Adian took a sip from the brandy, but set it down. Alcohol wouldn't help him sort through the jumble of forming plans. So Adian half-listened to the others as he slipped into the steady rhythm, the beat to which he calculated all his battles and campaigns. Kaol watched Adian pace in the apartment, Murtagh and Wren having left to see to their own agendas. Adian said,
You want to tell me why you look like you're going to vomit?
You know everything I know, so it's easy to guess why,
Kaol said from his armchair, his jaw clenched. His fight with Dorian had left him in no hurry to get back to the castle,
even if he needed the prince to test out his theories on that spell. Dorian had been right about Selena, about Kaol resenting her darkness and abilities and true identity, but it hadn't changed how he felt.
"I still don't quite grasp your role in things, Captain," Adian said.
"You're not fighting for Aelin or for Terrasen. For what, then? The greater good? Your prince? Whose side does that put you on? Are you a traitor? Or a rebel?"
"No."
Kaol's blood chilled at the thought.
"I'm on neither side. I only wish to help my friend before I leave for Eniel."
Adian's lip pulled back in a snarl. "Perhaps that's your problem. Perhaps not picking a side is what costs you. Perhaps you need to tell your father you're breaking your promise."
"I will not turn my back on my kingdom or my prince," Kaol snapped. "I will not fight in your army and slaughter my people. And I will not break my vow to my father."
His honor might very well be all he would have left at the end of this. "What if your prince sides with us?"
"Then I will fight alongside him, however I am able, even if it's from Aniel."
"So you will fight alongside him, but not for what is right. Have you no free will, no wants of your own?"
"My wants are none of your concern."
"And those wants..."
"Regardless of what Dorian decides, he would never sanction the killing of innocents."
A sneer.
"No taste for blood."
Kaol wouldn't give him the satisfaction of rising to meet his temper. Instead, he went for the throat and said,
"I think your queen would condemn you if you spilled one drop of innocent blood. She would spit in your face. There are good people in this kingdom, and they deserve to be considered in any course of action your side takes."
Adian's eyes flicked to the scar on Kaol's cheek.
"Just like how she condemned you for the death of her friend."
Adian gave him a slow, vicious smile. And then, almost too fast to register, the general was in his face, arms braced on the wings of the chair. Kaol wondered if Adian would strike him, or kill him, as the general's features turned more lupine than he'd ever seen them. Nose crinkled, teeth exposed. Adian said,
"When your men have died around you, when you have seen your women unforgivably hurt, when you have watched droves of orphaned children starve to death in the streets of your city, then you can talk to me about sparing innocent lives. Until then, the fact remains, Captain, that you have not picked a side because you are still a boy, and you are still afraid. Not of losing innocent lives, but of losing whatever dream it is you're clinging to. Your prince has moved on. My queen has moved on. But you have not. And it will cost you in the end."
Kaol had nothing to say after that, and quickly left the apartment. He hardly slept that night, hardly did anything but stare at his sword, discarded on his desk. When the sun rose, he went to the king and told him of his plans to return to Aniel. Chapter 41. The next 2 weeks fell into a pattern, enough that Selena started to find comfort in it. There were no unexpected stumbles or turns or pitfalls, no deaths or betrayals or nightmares made flesh. In the mornings and evenings, she played scullery maid. Late morning until dinner she spent with Rowan, slowly, painfully exploring the well of magic inside her, a well that, to her horror, had no bottom in sight. The small things, lighting candles, putting out hearth fires, weaving a ribbon of flame through her fingers, were still the hardest. But Rowan pushed, dragging her from ruin to ruin,
the only safe places for her to lose control.
At least he brought food with him now, as she was constantly starving and could hardly go an hour without eating something. Magic gobbled up energy, and she was eating double or triple what she sometimes used to. Sometimes they would talk. Well, she would make him talk, because after telling him about Adian and her own selfish wish for freedom, she decided that talking was good. Even if she wasn't able to open up about some things, she liked hearing Rowan speak. She managed to get him to tell her about his various campaigns and adventures, each more brutal and harrowing than the next. There was a whole giant world to the south and east of Wendlin, kingdoms and empires she'd heard of in passing, but had never known much about. Rowan was a true warrior, who had walked on and off of killing fields, led men through hell, sailed on raging seas and seen distant, strange shores. Though she envied his long life, and the gift of seeing the world that went along with it, she could still feel the undercurrent of rage and grief beneath each tale. The loss of his mate that haunted him no matter how far he rode or sailed or flew. He spoke very little of his friends, who sometimes accompanied him on his journeys. She did not envy him the battles he had fought, the wars in far-off lands, or the bloody years spent laying siege to cities of sand and stone. She did not tell him that, of course. She only listened as he narrated while instructing her. And as she listened, she began to hate Maeve, truly hate her aunt in her core. That rage drove her to request legends about her aunt from Emrys every night. Rowan never reprimanded her when she asked for those stories, never showed any alarm. It came as some surprise when Emrys announced one day that Beltane was 2 days off, and they would begin preparations for their feasting and dancing and celebrating. Already Beltane. And according to Rowan, she was still far from ready to go to Dorinel, despite mastering the shift. Spring would now be in full bloom on her continent. Maypoles would be raised, hawthorn bushes decorated. That was about as much as the king would allow. There would be no small gifts left at crossroads for the little folk. The king permitted the bare bones only, with the focus squarely on the gods and planting for the harvest. Not a hint or whisper of magic. Bonfires would be ignited, and a few brave souls would jump across for luck, to ward off evil, to ensure a good crop, whatever they hoped would come of it. As a child, she had run rampant through the field before the gates of Orinth, the 1,000 bonfires burning like the lights of the invading army that would too soon be encamped around the White City. It was her night, her mother had said. A night when a fire-bearing girl had nothing to fear, no powers to hide. Aelin Fireheart, people had whispered as she bounded past, embers streaming from her like ribbons. Adian and a few of her more lethal court members trailing as indulgent guards. Aelin of the Wildfire. After days of helping Emrys with the food, and devouring it when the cook wasn't looking, she was hoping for a chance to relax on Beltane, but Rowan hauled her to a field atop the mountain plateau. Selena bit into an apple she'd pulled from her pocket and raised her brows at Rowan, who was standing in front of a massive pile of wood for the bonfire, flanked by 2 small unlit fires on either side. Around them, some of the demi-fae were still hauling in more wood and kindling, others setting up tables to serve the food that Emrys had been laboring over without rest. Dozens of other demi-fae had arrived from their various outposts, with little fanfare and much embracing and good-natured teasing. Between helping Emrys and training with Rowan, Selena hardly had time to inspect them, though a wretched part of her was somewhat pleased by the few admiring glances she caught being thrown in her direction by the visiting males. She didn't fail to notice how quickly they looked away when they beheld Rowan at her side.
though she did catch a few females looking at him with far warmer interest. She wanted to claw their faces off for it. She munched on the apple as she studied him now, in his usual pale gray tunic and wide belt, hood thrown back, and leather vam braces gleaming in the afternoon sunlight. Gods, she had no interest in him like that, and she was certain he had no inclination to take her to his bed either. Maybe it was just from spending so much time in her fey body that she felt territorial. Territorial and grumpy and mean. Last night she had growled at a female in the kitchen who would not stop staring at him, and had actually taken a step toward him as if to say hello. Selena shook her head to clear away the instincts that were starting to make her see fire at all hours of the day. "I assume you brought me here so I could practice." She chucked the apple core across the field and rubbed at her shoulder. She'd been feverish the night before, thanks to Rowan making her practice all afternoon, and had awoken exhausted this morning. "Ignite them, and keep the fires controlled and even all night."
"All three?"
"Not a question."
"Keep the end ones low for the jumpers. The middle one should be scorching the clouds."
She wished she hadn't eaten the apple.
"This could easily turn lethal."
He lifted a hand and wind stirred around her.
"I'll be here,"
he said simply, eyes shining with an arrogance he'd more than earned in his centuries of living. "And if I somehow still manage to turn someone into a living torch?"
"Then it's a good thing the healers are also here to celebrate."
She gave him a dirty look and rolled her shoulders.
"When do you want to start?"
Her stomach clenched, as he said,
"Now."
She was burning, but remaining steady, even as the sun set and the field became packed with revelers. Musicians took up places by the forest edge, and the world filled with their violins and fiddles and flutes and drums. Such beautiful ancient music that her flames moved with it, turning into rubies and citrons and tiger eyes and deepest sapphires. Her magic didn't manifest in only blue wildfire anymore. It had been slowly changing, growing these past few weeks. No one really noticed her, standing on the outskirts of the fire's light, though a few marveled at the flames that burned but did not consume the wood. Sweat ran down every part of her, mostly thanks to the terror of people jumping over the lower burning bonfires. Yet Rowan remained beside her, murmuring as if she were a nervous horse. She wanted to tell him to go away, to maybe indulge one of those doe-eyed females who kept silently inviting him to dance. But she focused on the flames and on maintaining that shred of control, even though her blood was starting to boil. A knot tightened in her lower back, and she shifted. Gods, she was soaked. Every damn crevice was damp.
"Easy,"
Rowan said as the flames danced a little higher.
"I know,"
she gritted out. The music was already so inviting, the dancing around the fire so joyous, the food on the table smelling so delicious. And here she was, far from it all, just burning. Her stomach grumbled.
"When can I stop?"
She shifted on her feet again, and the largest bonfire twisted, the flame slithering with her body. No one noticed.
"When I say so,"
he said. She knew he was using the people around them, her fear for their safety, to get her to master her control, but...
"I'm sweating to death, I'm starving, and I want a break." "Resorting to whining."
But a cool breeze licked up her neck, and she closed her eyes, moaning. She could feel him watching her, and after a moment he said,
"Just a little while longer."
She almost sagged with relief, but opened her eyes to focus.
She could hold out for a bit, then go eat and eat and eat. Maybe dance. She hadn't danced in so long. Maybe she would try it out here in the shadows, see if her body could find room for joy, even though it was currently so hot and aching that she would bet good money that the moment she stopped, she would fall asleep. But the music was entrancing, the dancers mere shadows swirling around. Unlike in Otterlin, there were no guards monitoring the festivities, no villagers lurking to see who might cross the line into treason and earn a pretty coin for whoever they turned in. There was just the music, and the dancing, and the food, and the fire. Her fire. She tapped a foot, bobbing her head, eyes on the three smokeless fires and the silhouettes dancing around them. She did want to dance. Not from joy, but because she felt her fire and the music meld and pulse against her bones. The music was a tapestry woven of light and dark and color, building delicate links in a chain that latched onto her heart and spread out into the world, binding her to it, connecting everything. She understood then. The word marks were a way of harnessing those threads, of weaving and binding the essence of things. Magic could do the same, and from her power, from her imagination and will and core, she could create and shape.
"Easy," Rowan said,
then added with a hint of surprise,
"Music. That day on the ice you were humming."
She registered another cool wind on her neck, but her skin was already pulsing in time with the drums.
"Let the music steady you."
Gods, to be free like this. The flames roiled and undulated with the melody.
"Easy."
She could barely hear him above the wave of sound filling her up, making her feel each tether binding her to the earth, each infinite thread. For a breath, she wished for a shapeshifter's heart, so she could shed her skin and weave herself into something else, the music or the wind, and blow across the world. Her eyes were stinging, almost blurry from staring so long at the flames, and a muscle in her back twinged.
"Steady."
She didn't know what he was talking about. The flames were calm, lovely. What would happen if she walked through them? The pulsing in her head seemed to say, "Do it, do it, do it."
"That's enough for now."
Rowan grabbed her arm, but hissed and let go.
"That is enough."
Slowly, too slowly, she looked at him. Her eyes were wide, the light of the fire making them almost ablaze. Fire. Her fire. She returned to the flame, submitted to it. The music and the dancing continued, bright and merry.
"Look at me,"
Rowan said, but didn't touch her.
"Look at me."
She could hardly hear him, as if she were underwater. There was a pounding in her now, edged with pain. It was a knife that sliced into her mind and her body with each pulse. She couldn't look at him, didn't dare take her attention from the fire.
"Let the fires burn on their own," Rowan ordered.
She could have sworn she heard something like fear in his voice. It was an effort of will, and pain spiked down the tendons in her neck. But she looked at him. His nostrils flared.
"Aelin, stop right now."
She tried to speak, but her throat was raw, burning. She couldn't move her body.
"Let go."
She tried to tell him she couldn't, but it hurt. She was an anvil, and the pain was a hammer, striking again and again.
"If you don't let go, you are going to burn out completely."
Was this the end of her magic, then? A few hours tending fires? Such a relief. Such a blessed relief, if it were true.
"You are on the verge of roasting yourself from the inside out,"
Rowan snarled. She blinked,
and her eyes ached as if she had sand in them. Agony lashed down her spine, so hard she fell to the grass. Light flared, not from her or Rowan, but from the fire surging. People yelled.